This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Coding Freedom, the Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking. That's the name of the new book by our guest Gabriella Coleman.
Perhaps the most insightful and important book about the internet, hacking, anonymous, etc. in the last decade.
We'll talk with director Steve Vittoria about his new film, Long Distance Revolutionary.
Unlike prior films about Mamiya's frame-up, this focuses on Mamiya, the public intellectual and left-wing public intellectual.
Stay with us.
City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Here on Law and Disorder, we've covered the Center for Constitutional Rights and the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or SNAPs, efforts to hold priests accountable for sexual abuse. We've interviewed Barbara Blaine, founder of SNAP, who herself was a survivor, and attorney Pamela Spies from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Last week, both groups filed a complaint urging the International Criminal Court in The Hague to investigate and prosecute Pope Benedict XVI and three top Vatican officials for crimes against humanity for what they described as abetting and covering up the rape and sexual assault of children by priests. The filing notes that high-level officials of the Catholic Church who failed to prevent and punish those criminal actions have to date enjoyed absolute impunity. Now, the prosecutor's office is going to analyze whether the alleged crimes fall under the International Criminal Court's jurisdiction. Experts in international law say the sexual abuse of minors by Roman Catholic priests was sufficiently heinous and widespread to be taken to this court. It's interesting, but Vatican officials often say that the decisions about priests accused of abuse are actually made by bishops, not by the Vatican hierarchy. And they say that the church is far more decentralized than the public is generally aware of. But lawyers and abuse victims from the U.S. and Europe, who held a news conference at the court last week when the papers were filed, said this action was necessary because all the investigations and the prosecutions of sexual abuse by Catholic priests in a number of countries have not been sufficient to prevent ongoing crimes and cover-ups. Two of the victims mentioned in the filing have alleged that the priests who abused them moved to different countries and are still in the ministry working with children, with the knowledge of church superiors. Pam Spies said national jurisdictions can't really get their arms around this, and she noted that prosecuting individual instances of molestation or assault hasn't gotten at the larger systemic problem. Their goal is accountability, and the ICC makes the most sense since this is a global problem. The filing cites five cases in which priests have been accused of abuse. In the Democratic Republic of Congo and the United States, the priests in these cases come from Belgium, India, and the U.S. Pamela Spies says she hoped to persuade the court that the cases are within its jurisdiction because they involve abuses, she said, again, were systematic and widespread. We look forward to reporting on the progress of this case in the future. The National Lawyers Guild received some very good news last week regarding Occupy protesters who were awaiting trial on February 11th. In a pattern that we've observed year after year, after protest and protest, and really a litany of unconstitutional actions by local police departments and municipalities, on February 8th, with no notice to defense counsel or the defendants, Boston prosecutors went to court and dismissed all criminal cases against five Occupy activists. They had awaited trial on February 11th, and in addition, the DA dropped all remaining charges against other activists from Occupy, still awaiting trial as a result of mass police arrests going back to October and December 2011. We feel the DA's decision amounts to, again, acknowledgement that we've seen in cities across the country of the unconstitutionality of the arrests and criminal charges levied against hundreds of Occupy Boston participants. It's really a statement by the state, a final admission that the Occupy encampments and activities were legal and afforded full constitutional protection. The Gill lawyers were actually ready to go to trial and contest the charges. They'd subpoenaed the mayor of Boston and the police commissioner and were going to ask them why they applied the Massachusetts trespass and unlawful assembly laws to impinge on First Amendment rights of protesters. I think it's worth noting, in this case as in others, the district attorney actually noted that the defendants had, quote, served a sentence. And we've seen this again and again, bringing defendants into the court system, tying them up for years on end, making them expend resources both in terms of time, money, the psychological threat of a court case looming over them, and really the interruption that it brings to daily life, is in and of itself punishment for engaging in free speech activities that the local governments find either a nuisance or offensive to whatever their corporate and government campaigns are. And as in the Occupy cases around the country, in many of these cases, we saw that the local police were in fact working in collusion with local financial institutions, with private security, and in many cases taking out large insurance policies beforehand or during the events. What that says to us is that local governments are ready to spend a lot of money and effort into quashing lawful First Amendment activities. We report on it time and time again. The pattern is becoming clearer. Free speech in this country is becoming more and more difficult to engage in. In an issue of great interest to both the National Lawyers Guild and the Center for Constitutional Rights, the New York Times recently reported on the fact that the legal profession is looking into making some radical changes to the educational system. This might include, for example, cutting back from a 3-year education to a 2-year program, requiring more on-the-ground training for prospective attorneys, and maybe even licensing technicians who aren't full lawyers. Factors contributing to this examination include a dramatic decline in this country in law school applications, the outsourcing of research over the internet, and a huge number of underemployed and greatly indebted law school graduates. In addition, as our listeners know, a high percentage of the legal needs of many Americans are going unmet. Cutbacks are happening in various states to legal aid programs and public defender programs. And general consensus exists that the current law school educational system, as we know it, is severely broken. Another factor that was discussed by a task force that has been established last summer and given 2 years to make recommendations is the fact that law school professors receive high pay and have been criticized as having often remote relationships with the actual practice of law. That means many of them are just academicians and may have never even engaged in the practice of law. And unfortunately, many of them are also rated very low in terms of their productivity. Over the years, bar associations and foundations around the country have called for similar changes in the academic environment, but they've had limited impact. Leaders in the profession are saying that now it's different. Although the task force was created and given a 2-year time frame, it's chaired by Randall Shepard, a former Chief Justice of the Indiana Supreme Court, who said that the urgency of the matter is likely going to result in recommendations coming probably a year earlier than planned. Some law schools are already trying to deal with the declining popularity of law schools by freezing their tuition and ending out-of-state surcharges. Others have started clinics that deal directly with the issues that affect people, including landlord-tenant mediation, environmental issues, and even death penalty clinics. Another problem is that graduates of many law schools arrive at their first jobs with little knowledge of the actual practice of law. Corporations hiring recent graduates are saying that large hourly bills are in effect going to train those recent graduates. And not surprisingly, corporations are no longer willing to do that. So we'll keep an eye on what's happening in terms of reform coming up in the next year. We look forward to keeping you informed of developments in this area as they happen over the next year.
In many interviews and discussions over the last 2 years, we've discussed the attacks on whistleblowers and particularly internet activists and hackers. The emerging movement of programmers, hackers, open source software people, and online communities has challenged and exposed corporate and government control and surveillance of the internet, of our communications, of the codes that people use for making computers run, and made these people the targets of prosecution. The latest target, unfortunately, who killed himself, really as a result of his persecution, was, of course, Aaron Swartz. Today, we talk with author Gabriella Coleman about her recently published and incredibly important book, Encoding Freedom, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking. It's a good place, in fact, the best place to start for those learning about the political significance of free software, intellectual property, the efforts to take on the neoliberal state with regard to controlling our freedom, and the morality of computer hacking. Gabriella Coleman joins us today. She is the Wolf Chair in Scientific and Technological Literacy in the Department of Art History and Communication Studies at McGill University. And she, as I said, is the author of Coding Freedom. Gabriella, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Your book, Coding Freedom, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking, for me was probably one of the most profound, important books I've read in the last decade. It was revelatory for me, and I don't understand anything about computers or hacking, so it was great. Heidi?
Gabriella, we wanted to start by noting that with hacking being in the news so prominently over the last couple of years, could you frame for us the overarching issues that are presented before we get into some technical questions?
Sure. So when you utter the word hacker, usually the image that pops into people's mind is a nefarious criminal. There's a lot more to hacking than that. That certainly can be the case with hacking. But really, hackers compose an extremely lively group of individuals who tend to be computer programmers and network administrators who actually are very committed to a range of civil liberties, such as free speech and privacy. And especially in the last decade, they've been really involved in all sorts of political activities as well. So that's a kind of general frame for hacking. And there's quite a bit of diversity even among hackers technically and ethically as well.
Now, when you mention civil liberties, I was intrigued by that. And I think you just had actually a recent article, which, again, I would recommend to people, called Geeks Are New Guardians of Our Civil Liberties. Now, all those things to people who are not involved in hacking or computers or coding or software, that all sounds, crazy to me, or interestingly crazy. Why do you see hackers and what coding and all this struggle over freedom of the internet or whatever term you use, why do you see that as a part of a struggle for civil liberties?
Hackers are, again, technologists, and they build, core technologies related to the internet. And through this production, they're keenly aware of the issues such as censorship, which impact the present and the future of the internet. And some hackers are really committed to ensuring internet freedoms for their own sort of productive autonomy. They want to, keep doing what they do, and they feel like access is incredibly important. They're really against censorship. They know that privacy is also really important. But beyond their own sort of productive autonomy, they're really starting to care about the broader issues relating to internet freedoms and how they relate to democracy at large.
That's great. And let me take you back for a second so we can get some terms out for our listeners who are not going to be familiar, or some of them may be. But first, the book is called Coding Freedom. And what is code, for starters? I mean, I use a computer, I press a button and I'm on Windows, or I'm on Apple, or I press a button and I get, Flash Player or whatever else. But there's something behind that, I guess, which is what we're calling code?
No, exactly. And it is a kind of term of art that a lot of people are not familiar with. When I ask my students, what is source code? They stare at me as if I've just said something in Chinese. But it's really quite simple. In order for software to be made, it must be written in a programming language such as C, C++, Python, and Perl, and it's written in source code. And these are the underlying directions of software. And one very prominent group of hackers who are committed to always having access to source code have actually invented or reinvented the law to make sure that that source code is eternally available. And they're very much against copyrights and patents and have created something called a copyleft to make sure the source code, which powers software, is always accessible to them.
Now you mentioned a couple of terms in the book. One is called F/OSS, and the other is words like Linux and Debian. And it's all related to something about being free versus what, you know, Windows might have as a source code that I'm not allowed to modify. Can you explain that?
Sure. So proprietary software, such as the Microsoft operating system, is behind lock and key. We just really do not have access to the underlying directions. There's a contingent within the hacker world who believes that access is not only good for the sake of improving technology, but is the morally right thing to do. That it's a collaborative practice, that everyone should have access to it, that there should be the freedom to access source code. There's other hackers who are a little less concerned about the ethics of access, and they're more concerned about the pragmatics of access. They're not necessarily into writing open source, which is that kind of more amoral term, for the sake of freedom, but for the sake of better technology.
Now, one thing you address in the book is among this community of people, there were two things that really struck me. One is that, I guess it's called, is it pronounced Linux or Linux?
Linux.
Linux. So that's an open source software program that that there's workers on all over the world that make it better, improve it, et cetera, from what I got out of the book. And those people, there were two fascinating things about it. One of them is that the argument that's always given for copyright or patents is that unless we patent or allow to copyright our inventions, like different kinds of software, then we're never going to get people working on those because people aren't going to make any money off them. And therefore, you have to have patents for this software. And what you say in the book and what you demonstrate is this with Linux is that this is free. 1,000 people work on it all over the world, and yet it's used now by corporations everywhere. So you can explain that a little bit?
Sure. So, yeah, you're precisely right. The kind of reigning explanation behind having strong intellectual property protections for invention is it's a necessary economic incentive for people to even produce. You know, they're not even going to open the door into production unless they're given strong property rights. And so Linux, which is an operating system, among, you know, thousands of other pieces of free and open source software, you know, proves that, you know, this economic logic does not hold true in all instances across time, space, and peoples. And so all these developers are like, no, we've got other incentive structures in place for producing, and we don't necessarily need these IP protections to engage in production.
That seemed very strong to me. And the other point you made on this was having to do with politics. And you're talking to three people who come out of what you would have to call, I don't know if you call it the hard left, but we call it the left. And you talk about the group that works on Linux as one that's, it's not apolitical in a certain way, but in some way, when someone on the group suggested, well, we ought to get involved in Occupy Wall Street or something, other people said, no, our software is open to everybody, and we're not going to try and splinter our movement by taking particular issues on. And you address that, by in an interesting way, you say, despite that, or almost despite that, what they're doing is still taking on neoliberalism and the neoliberal model. So just talk about that a bit.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating because I had sort of originally thought that these free software developers who were part of these large projects such as Debian were raging leftists or something. And what I found instead was something quite different, where the project itself collected people who individually have all sorts of political orientations. Some are kind of anti-capitalist, others are social democrats. Some have no problems with capitalism, right? It's a real sort of mix. And the project as a whole is very ethically committed to free software. This is Debian. And they have principles and charters, and people write essays about it. But as a whole, they never are going to go beyond that software freedom to either critique capitalism or Christianity or to come out pro-capitalism either on the other side. And this is so because they feel like all these individuals who come together have such different political sensibilities. All they can agree on is free software. And then people should have the freedom to do what they want with that free software. Now, the reason why it's still a critique of neoliberal capitalism concerns the fact that, you know, especially related to trade organizations such as the World Trade Organization and the treaties like TRIPS, there is a strong, strong thrust in neoliberal capitalism to make property out of everything. And free software developers say, no, this is not right. We have to put some serious limits on that drive to make property out of everything from software to water.
Gabriella, we want to slightly switch gears now and talk a little bit about Anonymous, SOPA, some government laws sort of regulating the cyberspace. Even though everyone's heard of Anonymous, can you just give us a little explanation and sort of bring us up to date on activities of the last 2 years in terms of how it fits into your theses?
Sure. So Anonymous is fascinating because unlike the world of free software, which isn't really about street protests and getting involved in every cause, Anonymous, on the other hand, is a phenomena, a digital phenomena, somewhat composed of hackers, but not exclusively so, who have engaged an enormous amount of political activities, from providing technological support to the Occupy movement and the Arab Spring, to, you know, defending core freedoms of the internet and fighting censorship and restrictive intellectual property laws. And what's fascinating about them is, again, their willingness to jump into any and every kind of political event in the world, from the Philippines to Quebec to, of course, anything that happens on the internet. And they are kind of innovating in the realm of direct action related to digital protests. So some will engage in hacking to get at corporate corruption, to get information about corporate corruption to leak to the world at large. And very famously, they also engage in distributed denial of service attacks, where a website is so overloaded with requests, it comes offline for a little bit of time.
And can you talk about the legality of DDoS?
In the United States, it's criminalized under all circumstances. So it usually would fall under the purview of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And so currently, you know, there really isn't any either statutes or cases that would leave room for the DDoS as a form of political protest. It's not quite as heavily criminalized in all of Europe. And there's been one German court case where they didn't sort of explicitly rule that it was a legal form of protest, but they kind of intimated that it could be.
We always hear the argument about it, that it's really the equivalent of trespass and that they shouldn't be making it into these serious criminal offenses. I mean, is there some merit to that argument?
Yeah, and it's not even trespass. I mean, during a DDoS, there's no damage to data or servers whatsoever. Basically, a web page just has too many requests and it can't handle the load. It is certainly the case that those on the other side of a DDoS attack, a corporation or let's just say a nonprofit, will have to spend money. A network administrator might have to work extra time. There's resources that must be invested to prevent a DDoS. But it's really like a blockade for a short period of time where there's no damage done, again, either to the server or the data that's housed on the server.
We're speaking with Gabriella Coleman, author of Coding Freedom, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking. Gabriella, there's one expression that I tried to figure out exactly. I think I understand it. And it's called something like free beer or free speech. And it refers to really a lot of, or some of what you're talking about in the book. What does that mean, free beer or free speech?
When Richard Stallman, who is the kind of intellectual progenitor of the idea of free software and really wrote some key important applications and came up with a key license for free software, he often says, look, free software is not about free beer. as in you get stuff for free in a kind of commercial sense, but it's about free speech. It's about not having restrictions on what you say and what you do and how you share. Now, one of the interesting things is that free software, in order for it to be free speech, is also free beer at some level. Like, you have to make the source code available. But that doesn't prevent people from charging money either for the software or support or services. So, for example, my book is under a Creative Commons license, which is inspired by the world of free software, and it allows anyone to download it and share it. But I also have it on Amazon, where people can buy it as well. So when someone says something's free, as in speech, not beer, it means that it must be available for circulation. And it's not about just giving free things, although you often do have to make it available for free.
There's such tension between government regulation and this whole area of, as you say, a very broad and diverse community of hackers fighting for freedom on the internet. Can you tell us briefly what happened in response to SOPA and how you see this tension between the diverse world of hackers and a government that seems intent on really restricting internet freedom? Where do you see that going?
That was a fascinating case because SOPA was seen by a lot of internet activists as being, you know, really broad and overreaching the boundaries of current copyright law, giving powers to the government to, for example, preemptively take down websites where there was alleged copyright infringement going on. And so people felt like it was creeping way, way too close into the realm of just direct government censorship. And what's fascinating is that in some past instances, such as with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which had been passed in 1998, amid very little outcry, in the case of SOPA, there was massive outcry and massive organization to do something about it, to stop it in its tracks. And it came from very different quarters of society. It came from corporate giants like Google. It came from public interest groups like the Electronic Frontier Foundation. It came from small profit nonprofits like Demand Progress, and from, of course, Anonymous. And there was a huge blackout where people took down their websites in protest. And lo and behold, it had a massive effect. It stopped the statute in its tracks. Now, will there be something like that in the future? I'm sure there will be. That is not the end of sort of the copyright industries pushing for these very, very restrictive laws. I just think now we're in a better position to actually stop them before they become law, because there's an active group of individuals, nonprofits, and other civil society groups who are watchdogs tracking every single move made by the copyright industries.
Gabriella, I know that you wrote something very beautiful about Aaron Swartz, and I know he was involved in the efforts to stop the Online Privacy Act, or SOPA. Can you talk about that? And really, for me, who's sitting here as an outsider and, you know, represents some of the people involved in all in bit of this stuff, I mean, Julian Assange, I visited Jeremy Hammond. What's going on more broadly? It seems the government is, not just when it came to Aaron's case, but in a lot of these cases, just wanting to stamp it out with, like, the most force. You know, I can recall, really, since almost the 60s when they went after people with huge indictments. Can you give us a sense of what's the bigger picture here?
Sure. I mean, there's a couple of things going on when it comes to any form of hacking. Historically, and here I'm thinking about the late 80s and much of the 90s, there was a kind of robust transgressive tradition in hacking where hackers would break into systems not either for political cause and not to destroy anything or steal anything. It was a kind of playful transgression. And Kevin Mitnick is one of the famous hackers who's known for this. The U.S. courts really just wielded a very, very heavy hammer against those hackers and have continued to do so in the present, whether the hacking is, you know, full-on criminal, whether it's playful pursuit, or whether it's done for political activity. There's kind of no differentiation done between these three activities. And I think the figure of the hacker is one that provokes anxiety, and it's also one that's also very easy to convince a jury, hey, come on, hackers, they don't do anything good, right? They're just these kind of basement dwellers who want to cause havoc. So they become a very kind of easy target. Of course, we also know that the prosecutors in the United States wield a tremendous amount of power before a case even goes to trial, whereby they're able to sort of bring an enormous number of charges, which carry very long jail sentences and really, really, really expensive fines. They dangle that in front of someone and say, okay, take a plea bargain. We'll reduce everything, but you're going to admit guilt to all the charges and still have to pay a lot of money and spend time in jail. And a lot of people feel that this is not really a proper way for justice to ever be brought to bear. And this is a situation that, you know, most hackers will find themselves in, but also the public at large.
When you talk about what happened when DVDs were made, and they were only made so they could be used on a Windows machine or an Apple machine, and you're sitting out there with big operating systems of Linux, and then someone wrote, I don't know the official name for it, but a code so you could play it, play the DVDs on Linux. And the argument that you make in your book, or that they were making then, was that code is a form of speech and therefore ought to be protected by free speech protections, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. And as a way of illustrating that code was a form of speech, one of the people who you quote in here wrote a very long haiku, which someone who's smart like maybe you or other people could actually figure out what the code was for using a DVD on Linux. And I want you to talk about it. I just want to read a couple of my favorite paragraphs in the book, and it talks about how you get the source code. So this number is, once again, the player key, trade secret haiku, 81 and then 103, two times, then 200 less 3. And it goes on in that vein, so that someone reading that could see this is speech, but it's also the code. So can you talk about what was going on in that?
Yeah, it was fascinating. So under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it was illegal to decrypt the copy or access controls to a DVD. And a bunch of Linux hackers felt that this was, you know, basically crazy, and some had come up with a short piece of a program which allowed you to exactly decrypt access so that you could play it on your Linux machine, because you couldn't play most DVDs on a Linux machine. So this was illegal under the DMCA, and people were being sued who were posting this piece of software called DCSS online. And this threw the hacker community into a tizzy. They got all uppity, and they're like, wait a minute, you know, you can't be regulating technology in this very forceful way. And in fact, you know, source code and software is a form of free speech. And to prove it, we will take that original DCSS, which was written, you know, in one computer language, and we'll rewrite it in hundreds of other computer languages, and we'll also write it in poetry as well. And so this very, very smart programmer, Seth Schoen, took that program, and he at once was writing to the judges who were hearing the case, explaining that source code was both math and poetry at once. And then he reinstantiated the program into haiku poetry to prove his point.
Yeah, well, it's just a favorite part. When I came across it, I was flying somewhere, and I just turned to my neighbor, and I just read them part of the haiku. It was great. Gabriella, we're going to finish up now, but I want two things from you before we close. We've been interviewing you about coding freedom. One is where your website is, which was great because I got to read all those articles about Aaron Swartz and others that you've been writing, and you can get your book. Secondly, what's your next book?
Sure. So I'm currently working on a book on Anonymous, and that should be definitely done during 2013, so look out for it. And the website is GabriellaColeman.org, and there you can find all my publications and download my book as well.
Gabriella, you are a hero to so many of us. Amazing. Congratulations on this magnificent addition to the field.
Really amazing. It's just must reading for anybody who wants to understand what's going on today with internet prosecutions, freedom, etc. Thanks, Gabriella.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Abu Jamal is serving a life sentence, although now off death row, after having been framed up in 1981 for the murder of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. A new documentary, Long Distance Revolutionary, A Journey with Mumia Abu Jamal, is premiering here in New York at the Cinema Village Theater, as well as around the country. The film includes interviews from Cornel West, Alice Walker, Ruby Dee, Dick Gregory, Amy Goodman, Michael Parenti, Tariq Ali, and Michelle Alexander, among others. The film beautifully captures the importance of Mumia Abu Jamal, his life as a journalist and really as a radical public intellectual. He's published, so far, 7 books in prison, including the best-selling Life from Death Row. Cornel West says in the film, the state is very clever in terms of keeping track, especially of courageous and visionary people, the ones that are the long-distance runners. You can keep track of them, absorb them, dilute them, or outright kill them, and then you don't have to worry about opposition to them. We're joined today by documentary filmmaker Stephen Vittoria, who wrote, directed, and produced, and then edited Long Distance Revolutionary, A Journey with Mumia Abu Jamal. Welcome, Stephen, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on.
Stephen, my wife and I saw the movie last Sunday, and it's just an extraordinary, wonderful movie. We were so grateful that you and others collaborated in making it. And the thing that struck me was that it really wasn't a movie about Mumia being framed up for the murder of Officer Daniel Faulkner and put away for life. It talked about that, but the thrust of the movie really was about Mumia as a journalist and a public intellectual and an extraordinarily courageous and productive man. And I wanted to ask you, what was your thinking and how did it come to pass that you made that the thrust of the movie?
Well, there were really 2 reasons. One, from the creative aesthetic standpoint, the arc of Mumia's life and the body of his work, which is remarkable under harsh and draconian conditions, is much more than December 9th, 1981, the one moment in his life that the life got sucked out of his life. And I have always seen the arc of his story and the arc of his life as a hell of a lot more than just one moment and the follow-up, which was an obvious miscarriage of justice. And as Bob Dylan called Reuben Hurricane Carter's case, it was an absolute pig circus, and the same thing happened for Mumia. So I really wanted to tap into what I found was clearly a unique story. Here's a young man who early on realized he was a revolutionary. By the time he's 15 years old, he's writing remarkable work for the Black Panther Party and their newspaper. By the time he's 26, he's a vibrant, up-and-coming radio broadcaster and journalist in Philadelphia, reaches National Public Radio and All Things Considered. And then after incarceration, again, as I said, under really harsh conditions, he publishes 7 or 8 books, thousands of broadcasted essays, and he has impacted social and political discourse all over the planet. From a practical standpoint, one of the reasons I didn't focus on his case, but really his entire life's work, is the fact that every film, every book, every video, every article, that even every live event that's ever been produced about Mumia focuses on the case. And for me to mine that same material again, just one, seemed boring for me, and two, we probably wouldn't be talking now because the film would be undistributable and wouldn't be in theaters. So, you know, I did it from a creative standpoint and from a very, very practical standpoint.
Stephen, I think the film came out really at a pivotal time in terms of public awareness about Mumia, and coming off the fact that he was taken off of death row a year ago. For many of us, your film represents an important contribution to what we're calling informally a campaign of mainstreaming Mumia. And I think that means portraying him as the person and the creative individual that you did. I think it was very important to see that there were reviews in the New York Post, the New York Times, that didn't fall back on the rhetoric cop killer, but actually talked about the film and recognized the importance of this individual voice behind bars. That, to me, was really a measure and testament to what you've done.
You know, Heidi, that really hit me, too. You know, I wasn't... you know, when you do a film like this, you really don't expect the gatekeepers at the New York Times and some of these other fish wraps, as I like to call them, to really embrace films that have a strong point of view, a strong voice from the left. You know, they will embrace strong voices from the right, and they love to embrace, you know, milquetoast voices in the center. But they're really not used to a very strong, unabashed point of view from the left. And when I read the New York Times review, the first thing that hit me, and I give the writer credit, he came right out at the top and called Mumia an activist and a journalist. And it stopped me, like it probably stopped you. I mean, if the film can change the dialogue or help to change a dialogue, because there's a lot of people out there trying to change the dialogue, it's a great puzzle piece. I don't know if any film can ever free somebody from the conditions that he's in, but I always saw the film as, one, I wanted to tell a really good story. Any filmmaker, that's job number one, is to tell a great story. And Mumia, it was, you just have to turn the camera on and you can tell a great story. But I'm witnessing the writers writing that in very positive reviews and in very negative reviews. And I always expect it to get positive and negative. If you get reviews right down the middle, then you're not doing your job. I was visiting Mumia last week, and we both said that if the film starts to win awards and starts to get fawned over, then something's wrong. You know, we really, if you're trying to stir people up, if you're trying to let them see the truth, and you're probably going to get a lot more angst and a lot more pushback than if you're just sort of serving them something really easygoing.
You know, on the question of Mumia's guilt, though, Steve, although you didn't take it on directly, we as lawyers know that when you pick a jury, you tell the jury, we want you to use your life experience and evaluate the credibility and the demeanor of every witness and of the defendant, and then come to your own conclusion. And so when you tell the story of Mumia's life, and the viewers as the jury appreciate it, even though you don't make the point directly that this thing was a frame-up, people come to so respect Mumia that they realize that he was framed up. So you got there even though you didn't intentionally try to get there. But I wanted to ask you, you start with Mumia as a boy and his family. You interview his sister, and you kind of give people a broader understanding of who he was and where he came from. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. It was really important for me as a storyteller and a filmmaker to put Mumia's life in context. I mean, all of our lives need to be put into context. Who we are now is, you know, history defines the future. And it was so important for me to drill down into Mumia's early life, you know. And, you know, we have a lot of so-called political luminaries in the film. My favorite interview in the entire film is Mumia's sister, Lydia Barashenko, who unfortunately passed away just a couple of months after we interviewed her from her bout with cancer. And I'll tell you, she really did, she went to great lengths to secure her baby brother's legacy. And we're going to include a lot more of her interview on the DVD, quite frankly, because she's just brilliant. And I thought the idea of, digging into Mumia's, spiritual quest at the age of 9, 10, 11, as he walked around the neighborhood and he was literally interviewing, rabbis and priests and ministers. And, he was going to mosques and temples. That early part of his journalistic side of his brain was already coming out. He was searching for answers, and I thought that was so important. And then, trying to find out about what it was like as a young African-American kid growing up in one of the great racist northern cities of Philadelphia, what it was like, what he felt. I really wanted the film to be a journey with Mumia Abu-Jamal, and not a journey with Stephen Vittori, who grew up in the suburbs in New Jersey, and that's truly not interesting. But what's interesting is about what affected Mumia, how the great love that the people in his family had for each other, and how he fought out of, attempting to change his high school to Malcolm X High School. I mean, people that are 14, 15 years old just don't do that kind of thing unless they kind of have a special star over their head from a political standpoint. And I think people needed to know that when it came to COINTELPRO and the FBI and Rizzo and the surveillance state, that they had their eyes on, then Wesley Cook, soon to be Mumia Abu-Jamal, when he was 14, 15, 16 years old. And Cornel West says it best in the movie, I think. He says they knew early on they had a very special revolutionary in their sights, and they wanted to keep an eye on him. And here we are 40-some-odd years later, and Mr. Ratner can tell us a great deal about the surveillance state. So I thought that's why it was so important.
Talking about journeys, Stephen, what was your journey like in terms of the process of making the film? Were there any surprises during the way?
There weren't any giant surprises. I wish I had one for you. The biggest surprise for me, and I had been inspired by Mumia's writing, and Mumia and I had worked on another project together that did not come to fruition as a film, but it's coming to fruition as a book for the two of us right now, called Murder Incorporated, Empire, Genocide, and Manifest Destiny, that we're both writing together. But probably the biggest surprise, Heidi, for me was not knowing Mumia at the time. I took him on as a very serious journalist and serious writer and a black nationalist, and I didn't realize how funny and sometimes goofy he can be. Our visits together and our conversations together are 50% political, social type stuff, and then 50% two guys sitting in a bar and just laughing about things and, talking about what's the next weird thing that Mel Gibson's going to do, or we talk about The Walking Dead, or, he's kind of a science fiction nerd. He calls himself a nerd, and he loves reading, Star Trek and things like that. Those are the kinds of things I didn't know about Mumia. Just kind of the teddy bear guy that he is a lot of the times. And he does really good impressions. He does a remarkable impression of George W. Bush. And it there's tears in my eyes when he does it, because his whole body starts to shake and he takes on. He's really, really funny. So that was the joy in me, is he's, I think people on the left, Michael Moore says it, we need a much better sense of humor. We think way too heavy about things sometimes. We should laugh more. And I think Mumia understands that.
I really liked some of the things Dick Gregory said. You had a great range of interviewees in the film that really captured different essences.
Yeah, the one I liked was our friend Frances Golden, and she was describing Mumia's work ethics. And she said, you go visit him, and he's got 10 fingers, but then he's got a callus growing out of his index finger on his right hand that's as big as like 11 fingers.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you about that, because what is his routine? How the hell do you write 7 books from death row? How do you do the research? Where do you get, you know, he doesn't have a computer. He doesn't even have a ballpoint pen. How did he do it?
It really is a great mystery until you realize he does it with just incredible hard work, dedication. He has a schedule. I never really realized this until I started writing with him, but Mumia has a very strict schedule for work, as if he's going out with a lunch pail in the morning and a helmet on, and he's going into the trenches. He takes days off where he doesn't write. You know, unfortunately, Mumia has a lot of time on his hands, and that's something we all want to try to make that stop. We want to get him busy in the outside world. But while he's there, he really works hard, and I think that the one muscle that he gets to work more than any other muscle, Dick Gregory talked about this, and I think it's right, is that everything from a sexual standpoint, from a physical standpoint, everything has gone into his brain, and his brain has just, it just works overtime, and he reads voraciously, as Francis Golden says, and he buys books with the little money that he has, and then there are people, I know writing with him now, I send books in from Amazon all the time. I can't send them myself. I have to go through a bookseller. You know, people that care, people that love him, people that want to see his work continue will get him books, and he's just a voracious reader, and I think that any great writer is obviously doing a great amount of reading. And but to answer your question in 2 words, hard work.
Stephen, we are fortunate enough to have a clip that you've provided for us that we're going to play. Can you help us set this up?
This is a clip that we put together primarily from the introduction of the film, and I think it's a number of different people sort of setting up who Mumia Abu-Jamal, the man, is, and why they are so intrigued with him, and why others need to understand what he has to go through to get his voice out into the public discourse.
Let's have a listen.
You have a collect call from
Mumia Jamal,
an inmate at the State Correctional Institution at Green.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is one of the lost souls of the revolution.
Mumia, how are you dealing with all of this darkness and despair and despondency and so forth? He said, let me write about it. I'll tell the truth about it. It's a living hell. It's a nightmare.
They have contained his body, and they're trying to figure out how to shut him down entirely.
They have moved heaven and earth to stop his voice being heard in the United States.
I know a lot of political prisoners, and Mumia is locked down as hard as anyone I've ever met. But I've also never met anybody that has such a warmth and such a sense of humor and such a perspective on the world.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is a revolutionary person. So he's like a guerrilla in the jungle, in a tent in the rain, writing to the community with next to nothing.
You come through at a time that your technology was there that could go around the world. And one day we will find out that he was the voice of America. The voice of America is a fraud.
When you're pushing the lie, the truth is very threatening.
Powerful governments like to control. They love to control. And they love to silence people. They cannot silence Mumia.
And he's somebody who the state of Pennsylvania thinks needs to die.
We would not be who we are as African Americans of this day were it not for the Reverend, the Prophet Nat Turner, who brilliantly merged the religious and the political, who didn't just talk about the world to come, but fought to transform the world that is.
That was a clip from the new film Long Distance Revolutionary, A Journey with Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And we're speaking with filmmaker Stephen Vittoria. Stephen, the film is in New York, but when people listen to this program, it's still going to be playing at the Cinema Village over on 12th Street and University. And then it's opening up in a number of cities around the country, L.A., Seattle, and so on. And we're going to ask our producer, please put that up on our website, Law and Disorder, so that people will know where they can see the film outside of New York City.
Stephen, do you have a website for the film?
We do. It's mumia-themovie.com. Mumia-themovie.com. And we have, you can see where it's playing everywhere in the country. There are blogs. There are numerous videos. You can watch outtakes, behind the scenes, and just follow the film from there. And if you like us on Facebook, you'll keep up to date on when the DVD is coming out and home video and all the rest.
Stephen Vittoria, thank you so much for this important contribution.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Stephen, you've made a movie that illuminates Mumia and shows, I think, everybody that sees it, that we have amongst us another Frederick Douglass. Great job.
Thank you, amazing,
Stephen. I haven't seen it, but I'm dying to get there now, and I particularly am happy at what you emphasized about Mumia. It's the first time.
Please let me know what you think, Michael.
Great.
I would love to hear your thoughts.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Thank you.